Advised.
Good evening, everybody. It is 11 o'clock, and thank you for joining us for the 46th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Wonderful job as always, Dr. Mathis. And if you would, please, can you let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic?
Well, sure. As been so common of me of late, that's another shameless marketing tool. That's an excerpt from a rock opera called JDM, and the name of the tune is called Test. It's not the same kind of test we're going to be talking about tonight. It's more of a test of you know, somebody's character while they're being seduced by a succubus. So it's a very interesting kind of one of those mystical rock opera kind of dillies. But I thought since the title had the word test in it, it would be kind of a cool sequitur into our show tonight, which deals with psychological testing and emotional testing. So that's why I chose it.
Excellent. Okay, thank you for that. And I'm going to take a real quick pause and give a shout out to Roger Noriega of NDB Media. He is joining us tonight, listening to us, but is not able to log into the chat room. But I wanted to greet him and thank him for joining us. So as Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled The Myers-Briggs Myth. We all have heard of the Myers-Briggs test, and that's what we're talking about. But before we begin tonight's discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so if our listeners remember in our previous installments, I gave history of Vox and Marshall amplifiers. So tonight I thought I would pick on something that most people have heard. In fact, I would venture to say every one of our listeners has heard this particular instrument a multiplicity of times, although they probably aren't aware they have. So tonight I'm going to be talking about an instrument called the mellotron, which is probably, arguably, for lack of a better term, the first synthesizer, and I put that in quotes. It actually started back in 63 and was taken over in 1970 by another company and produced until 86 when they stopped marketing them because they sort of fell out of favor until around 2007 when the same company, I think it was Streetly Electronics, has picked them back up, and now they're back on the market and they're hotter than ever. So what a mellotron is basically it's an electrical, kind of electromagnetic, mechanical kind of dilly. It's a keyboard, but it doesn't synthesize sounds the way an old school analog like a Moog or an ARP did it, which didn't come out till the late 60s, early 70s. It actually used tapes. And unlike the Moogs and the early synthesizers and the ARPs and the ARPs, all of those were monophonic, which means you could only hit one key because they only had one LFO or frequency oscillator going, so you could only hit one note at a time. The mellotrons were polyphonic. You played them, you know, you could play multiple keys at the same time like you do on an organ or a keyboard. And how they made these sounds is they were digitally sampled sounds of symphonies or other keyboards or whatever, and then they were put on tape. And the tape was put on kind of this endless loop on a very, very, very long, sticky-looking thing that kind of went into the back of the keyboard. So where the strings are on a piano were these rows of these little tapes. And the tapes were tape recordings of things like cellos, violas, string sections, harmonicas, whatever. And you went across a capstan head just like you do in an old-school tape machine player. And when you'd hit a key, it would push the tape against the capstan's head, and you'd have the sound coming out that was the sound of the instrument because it was, you know, highly sampled and done very, you know, very much technicality-wise. It was really great, and it sounded really, 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 really good. And it was actually initially it was promoted for home use for folks to amuse themselves in the home and have like little orchestras in the home. And people, everybody from Eric Robinson, who's an old-school band leader, to the actor David Niven, to you know, for gosh sakes, Princess Margaret had one.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, you were like, huh? Right? So as they became like people started hearing about them, the musicians started hearing about them, then you had people who were, you know, rock and roll musicians who were using them because it saved them having to hire orchestra people to come in and do the stuff. So one of the earliest things on record, if you will, which it really literally was on a record back then, were the Beatles, who used mellotrons a lot. And in fact, all of my listeners have heard innumerable times Strawberry Fields Forever. And you have the intro, that's the little pipe organy sounding thing. That's a Mellotron.
Mm-hmm.
Right, then, let me take you down. And the thing kind of goes, right? That's a knob on the Mellotron where you turn the timbre and the toning and the tuning of the thing down with a knob. So that's how they got that weird deal. But, you know, other people who use the Mellotron a lot were the old school Genesis. King Crimson used it extensively, and so did Moody Blues. So Nice and White Satin, the symphonic stuff, that's all Mellotron.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
And, yeah, and eventually people like OMD, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, which
dark,
was a...
Yeah. I love
right,
those guys.
And, well, Mellotron.
Oh,
so,
yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it, you know, and you can get spacey crap, you know, sounding them, but it's mostly symphonic kind of noise. And even XTC has used it. So these things were really touchy because they were tape, you know, Zeppelin used them. So Stairway to Heaven, for example, all that flute, the ocarina sound, that's all Mellotron. So the problem with these things is the tapes, you know, when heat and weather and humidity, they would really wreak havoc on these things. And the band, yes, used them also. And so when they'd go on tour, you'd have to usually have two or three of these things on tour. And they weren't cheap. They were like 10 grand a pop at the time. And so, you know, 68, 70, 73, that's a boatload of money.
Yeah.
And they would have to take several of these on tour because they were so temperamental. You'd have to warm them up 30 minutes to an hour before the gig, you know, before you were even going to do the sound check, because the tapes would stretch and they had to be warmed up and, you know, and they'd break, and it was just all kinds of crazy crap going on. So they were very unhandy, but they sounded fabulous when they worked, right? Robert Fripp used them and used to make jokes about them. You know, you can't really tune one of these things. They're kind of like not tunable. and that's because they were so doggone temperamental because of the weather and the heat and the humidity and all that kind of stuff made the reliable. If you had too much smoke, and, you know, back in the day you were smoking in these arenas and all that stuff would get on tape heads, and it would just totally screw them up. And they'd, you know, this is why they quit being used. And so they were in the studio before using them. Well, in fact, Mountain, Felix Popolardi, who played keyboards, he was predominantly the bass player for Mountain. Steve Knight was the keyboard player, but in the studio, Popolardi did most of the keyboards. So he was an early adopter of the Mellotron and used it on the Cream stuff, because most people probably don't know, but Felix Popolardi is the producer of all the Cream albums. So when you hear the Mellotron on White Room, the doo, you know, that's all Mellotron. That's Popolardi. So, yeah. So anyway, they were still being used in the studio, and the orchestra guys got really PO'd. They tried to ban it in the studio because it was taking money out of their pocket, you know. So anyway, around, you know, I think it was 86, they eventually stopped making them, because then all the digital synthesizers started coming around the mid-80s, right, with Kurzweil and all that stuff. And so these things kind of went out of favor. Well, they've sort of been rediscovered in the 2000s, and the producers started making them again, but now they're all digital. They don't rely on tape anymore. So they're incredibly more reliable and, you know, based on the new digital stuff, which wasn't, you know, that technology wasn't available back in the day. Mm-hmm. You know, you just didn't have it. So now they've become really cool commodities. And so the old school Mellotrons, which were based on a Chamberlain, which was a similar instrument, all those came out, the MK1, the MK2, and the FX console, which was a huge double keyboard kind of thing that looked more like a kind of a double size harpsichord almost. You know, those things were all 60s inventions, and the M300 and the M400. And I think there was a special one that EMI, music company in Britain, made, and I think it was the EMI M400, or I forgot. I think that's right. And then the Mark V came out and all this kind of stuff. And so eventually when they stopped and they started back production again, in the 2000s, and they were made, you know, these other guys made kind of what I would call Mellotron wannabes here and there through the 90s. The company that really started it back, which was the Streetly Electronics, when they started coming back out with them in 2007, then, you know, they started reproducing digital versions of all the Omellotrons, and they had all the old tapes, so they digitally sample all the old tapes and put it in some. And it's really it's a really unique and cool instrument that a lot of people don't know. And it was the first polyphonic synthesized-esque kind of thing, but it didn't rely on analog computer circuits like traditional synthesizers like the Mini-Moogs or the ARP Odysseys or whatever. It relied on tapes of digital sampled orchestration things. So it was really weird and really pricey and cumbersome and a pain in the patootie, but it sounded marvelous. So they were in use a lot in the studio, and bands who could afford to have several of them and techies on tour with them used them. So anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking with it. So there's your Mellotron history.
Fabulous. Okay. Thank you for that. And again, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the rest of the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. So tonight's show is called the Myers-Briggs Mess. The Myers-Briggs type indicator is regarded in our culture as the most popular personality test in America, and has grown since it became commonly heard of in the 1980s. It has its critics, and tonight we will be discussing its history, as well as what we believe are its failings, some misconceptions about the test, and what we recommend our listeners look into instead. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything that you want to say before we get started.
Now, I'm going to save my commentaries till later. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so the first part that we want to talk about is the history of the Myers-Briggs test. And this is a timeline of history leading up to the Myers-Briggs Personality Indicator Test as we know it. And this is sourced from their official website, myersbriggs.org. So the history of this goes all the way back to 1923, which is where we start. In 1923, the English translation of Carl Jung's Psychologische Typen, which is psychological types in, he's not German. I want to say he's either Belgian or Swiss. I cannot remember. I'm sorry. And that was put out in 1921. The translation into English appeared in the United States, and that is what all of this is based on. In 1923 also, Catherine Cook Briggs and daughter Isabel Briggs Myers began their study of Jung. 1926, Catherine Briggs publishes a pioneering article about personality type in the source The New Republic on December 22nd. In 1941 through 43, Myers and Briggs began to measure type as a way of helping people to choose suitable work and to promote the constructive use of differences. In 1962, Isabel Myers self-publishes Introduction to Type with the goal of providing information to help people integrate type into their daily lives. In 1962 also, Educational Testing Services publishes Isabel Myers' MBTI Manual, as well as the Form F instrument, which was primarily used for research until 1977. In 1964, Isabel Myers presents her seminal paper, Relation of Medical Students' Psychological Type in Their Specialties 12 Years Later. Also in 1964, Mary McCauley, PhD, started Typology Laboratory at the University of Florida and develops the computer scoring program. In 1968, Catherine Cook Myers passes away. It is unclear at what point she retired from research and involvement in the project. We're guessing about somewhere in the 50s. In 1975, Myers and McCauley established the Center for Applications of Psychological Type, or CAPT, as an independent, not-for-profit organization. Also in 75, Myers contracts with Consulting Psychologist Press, CPP, in Palo Alto, California, to be the publisher of the MBTI instrument. Also in 75, Isabel Myers talks with Gordon Lawrence during the first international MBTI conference held in Gainesville, Florida. And there is a side note, author Gordon D. Lawrence is apparently still living and listed as a celebrity speaker, but it was nearly impossible to find even a simple biography for him online, even though he's listed as an Amazon author and vendor. By that, I mean he has books on Amazon's website. At most, I found that he co-authored the book People Types and Tiger Stripes with a gentleman named Charles Martin. 1979, the Association for Psychological Type, APT, is formed as a membership organization with Catherine Myers as first president. Please note that Catherine Downing Heisler Myers is not Catherine Cook Briggs. She is the second wife of Isabel's son, Peter Briggs Myers, who just recently passed away in March of 2018. Also in 79, publication of Gifts Differing by Isabel Myers and Peter Myers. This book elaborates Isabel's concept of constructive use of differences. 1980, Isabel dies of cancer on May 5th. CAPT establishes the Isabel Meyer Briggs Memorial Library, which will become the largest collection of MBTI-related materials in the world. In 1984, in support of Isabel's vision to spread the use of the indicator all over the world, the Myers and Briggs Foundation is created. 1984 also, CPP publishes MBTI Step 2 Form Q, based on Isabel's work. Preferences are expanded to explain why people of the same type may behave differently. In 1985, Catherine D. Myers and Margaret Hartzler create the first publisher-approved MBTI qualifying program, paving the way for today's MBTI certification program. In 2003, CAPT continues the work and research to bring Isabel's Step 3 form to fruition. Lifelong development is the foundation of this highly personalized version of the indicator. In 2009, the MBTI Master Practitioner Program is established, giving MBTI practitioners a way to increase their knowledge, build new competencies, and promote their expertise. Also in 2009, CPP and CAPT released the MBTI Step 3 tool, which includes an additional scale for interpretation by licensed clinicians and fulfills a dream of Isabel Myers. In 2013, CAPT releases Mary and Isabel's library online. It's referred to as Milo, providing web access to the Isabel Myers-Briggs Memorial Library. And that is the history of the test and things related to the test. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you'd like to add at this time.
No, good job.
All right. So, Section 2 is criticisms of the MBTI, which is kind of why we're here tonight. These criticisms are compiled somewhat from Wikipedia, which gives additional sources for them, but I'm not going to hyper-document because there's quite a bit of stuff here. So the first comment, been estimated that between a third and half of the published material on the MBTI has been produced for the special conferences of the Center for the Application of Psychological Type, which provides the training in the MBTI and are funded by sales of the MBTI. Or as papers in the Journal of Psychological Type, which is edited and supported by Myers-Briggs advocates and by sale of the indicator. It has been argued that this reflects a lack of critical scrutiny. Many of the studies that endorse MBTI are methodologically weak or unscientific. A 1996 review by Gardner and Martinko concluded, it is clear that efforts to detect simplistic linkages between type preferences and managerial effectiveness have been disappointing. Indeed, given the mixed quality of research and the inconsistent findings, no definitive conclusion regarding these relationships can be drawn. Psychometric specialist Robert Hogan wrote, most personality psychologists regard the MBTI as little more than an elaborate Chinese fortune cookie. Point number two, there's no evidence for dichotomies. As described in the four dichotomies section, Isabel Myers considered the direction of the preference, for example, E versus I, extrovert versus introvert, to be more important than the degree of the preference. Statistically, this would mean that scores on each MBTI scale would show a bimodal distribution, with most people scoring near the ends of the scales, thus dividing people into either, for example, an extroverted or an introverted psychological type. However, most studies have found that scores on the individual scales were actually distributed in a centrally peaking manner, similar to a normal distribution, indicating that the majority of people were actually in the middle of the scale and were thus neither clearly introverted nor extroverted. Point C, validity and utility. The content of the MBTI scales is problematic. In 1991, a National Academy of Sciences committee reviewed data from MBTI research studies and concluded that only the IE scale had high correlations with comparable scales of other instruments and low correlations with instruments designed to assess different concepts, showing strong validity. In contrast, the SN and the TF scales showed relatively weak validity. The 1991 review committee concluded at the time there was, quote, not sufficient, well-designed research to justify the use of the MBTI in career counseling programs, end quote. Point D, lack of objectivity. The accuracy of the MBTI depends on honest self-reporting. Unlike some personality questionnaires, such as the 16-PF questionnaire, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, or what we refer to as the MMPI, or the Personality Assessment Inventory, the MBTI does not use validity scales to assess exaggerated or socially desirable responses. As a result, individuals motivated to do so can fake their responses. And one study found that the MBTI judgment perception dimension correlates weakly with the Einsek Personality Questionnaire Lie Scale. If respondents, quote, fear they have something to lose, they may answer as they assume they should. Point E, terminology. The terminology of the MBTI has been criticized as being very vague in general, so as to allow any kind of behavior to fit any personality type, which may result in a Forer effect, where people give a high rating to a positive description that supposedly applies specifically to them. Some theorists, such as David Kiersey, have expanded on the MBTI descriptions, providing even greater detail. For instance, Kiersey's descriptions of his four temperaments, which he correlated with the 16 MBTI personality types, show how the temperaments differ in terms of language use, intellectual orientation, educational and vocational interests, social orientation, self-image, personal values, social roles, and characteristic hand gestures. Point F, correlation. According to Hans Einsek, the main dimension in the MBTI is called EI, or extroversion, introversion. This is mostly a sociability scale, correlating quite well with the MMPI social introversion scale negatively, and the Einsek extroversion scale positively. Unfortunately, the scale also has a loading on neuroticism, which correlates with the introverted end. Thus, introversion correlates roughly, i.e. averaging values for males and females, minus 0.44 with dominance, minus 0.24 with aggression, plus 0.37 with abasement, plus 0.46 with counseling readiness, minus 0.52 with self-confidence, minus 0.36 with personal adjustment, and minus 0.45 with empathy. The failure of this scale to disentangle introversion and neuroticism, parenthetically, there is no scale for neurotic and other psychopathological attributes in the MBTI, is its worst feature, only equaled by the failure to use factor analysis in order to test the arrangement of items in the scale. Bear with me just a moment here. I'm actually going to pause for just a minute and see if you want to add anything, Dr. Mathis, because I have another page and a half of notes first, so I didn't know if you wanted to jump in with anything.
And no, all I excuse me, all I will say is I would not disagree with any of these critiques.
Okay, fair. So point G, reliability. The test-retest reliability of the MBTI tends to be low. Large numbers of people, parenthetically between 39% and 76% of respondents, obtain different type classifications when retaking the indicator after only 5 weeks. In Fortune magazine, May 15, 2013, an article titled, "Have We All Been Duped by the Myers-Briggs Test?" stated, quote, "The interesting and somewhat alarming fact about the MBTI is that despite its popularity, it has been subject to sustained criticism by professional psychologists for over three decades. One problem is that it displays what statisticians call test-retest reliability, low retest reliability. So if you retake the test after only a five-week gap, there's around a 50% chance you will fall into a different personality category compared to the first time you took the test," end quote. A second criticism is that the MBTI mistakenly assumes that personality falls into mutually exclusive categories. The consequence is that the scores of two people labeled introverted and extroverted may be almost exactly the same, but they could be placed into different categories since they fall on either side of an imaginary dividing line. Within each dichotomy scale, as measured on Form G, about 83% of categorizations remain the same when people are retested within 9 months and around 75% when retested after 9 months. About 50% of people readministered the MBTI within 9 months remain the same overall type and 36% of the same type after more than 9 months. For Form M, the most current form of the MBTI instrument, the MBTI manual reports that these scores are higher. Of course it does, because it's, you know, internal. In one study, when people were asked to compare their preferred type to that assigned by the MBTI assessment, only half of people chose the same profile. Point H. It has been argued that criticisms regarding the MBTI mostly come down to questions regarding the validity of its origins, not questions regarding the validity of the MBTI's usefulness. Others argue that the MBTI can be a reliable measurement of personality. It just so happens that, quote, like all measures, the MBTI yields scores that are dependent on sample characteristics and testing conditions, end quote. And these are my words right here. It actually just sounds like laypeople with no formal training in any related disciplines just kept writing and making up things and somehow managed to convince the psychological community that they knew what they were doing. And today we take their credibility for granted, and we shouldn't. Two more points in here that were not from Wikipedia, they're from other sources. From an undated post on TheGuardian.com, Dr. Dean Burnett of the Institute of Psychological Medicine and Clinical Neuroscience at Cardiff University recently outlined a list of criticisms, including the test's reliance on binary choices, poor scientific foundations, and the suspicion that it is a self-fulfilling phenomenon. The more people take it, the more others feel they have an obligation to do so. The big problem, Burnett says, is that Myers-Briggs gives people a false impression of how psychology works, a false sense of expertise, end quote. Different quote. There's just no evidence behind it, says Adam Grant, an organizational psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, who's written about the shortcomings of the Myers-Briggs previously. Quote, the characteristics measured by the test have almost no predictive power on how happy you'll be in a situation, how you'll perform at your job, or how happy you'll be in your marriage, end quote. The test claims that based on 93 questions, it can group all the people in the world into 16 different discrete types, and in doing so serve as a powerful framework for building better relationships, driving positive change, harnessing innovation, and achieving excellence. Most of the faithful think of it as primarily a tool for telling you your proper career choice. But the test was developed in the 1940s based on the totally untested theories of Carl Jung and is now thoroughly disregarded by the psychology community. Even Jung warned that his personality types were just rough tendencies that he'd observed, rather than strict classifications. Several analyses have shown the test is totally ineffective at predicting people's success in various jobs, and that about half of the people who take it twice get different results each time. And the source for this was an article on Vox.com, Why the Myers-Briggs Test is Totally Meaningless, by Joseph Stromberg and Estelle Caswell. This was updated October 8th of 2015. And that's the end of this section, so I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if you'd like to add anything.
No, I think I'm going to save most of my comments for the next section. I will simply say that I would not severely disagree with anything that these other folks have said, since I'm not a huge proponent of the MBTI and prefer other tests that to me are much more realistic, reliable, yada, 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 you know. And I certainly have colleagues who differ with that. I mean, I was just chatting with my jam buddies tonight, who were all both psychology people, and they're like, oh, we really like that test. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I bet you eat chopped liver too. I hate liver too, so what do I know, right? But it was just interesting. And they were like, well, you know, we tend to use it for this, that, and the other. And I'm thinking, there are a lot of other better tests for that. And why are you using that? And they couldn't come up with a good answer except that it's quick and easy. And I'm like, yeah, no kidding. So whatever, you know, everybody has to do what they feel comfortable doing. It's certainly not my first or 1500th choice for quote unquote personality type testings by anybody's delusional imagination.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Okay, so section 3. Why do so many people believe in it, and why does it appear to work? So part A, why it's used is it's good business. The Myers-Briggs test is good business, worth $20 million a year in 2014. It is not freely available and is most commonly used as a psychometric testing or training in corporate environments. It is huge, with a quick internet search revealing pages and pages of offerings, with whole websites dedicated to particular types such as ENFP. Myers-Briggs has been described by Business Insider as entrenched in business culture, taken by 2.5 million people a year, and is used by 89 of the 100 Fortune 100 companies, as well as the CIA. And this is from an article from Business Insider in 2014. Point B, professionals don't actually believe it works. Uses in psychology and psychiatry, it's not commonly used within psychology or psychiatry. Psychology of personality most frequently uses the Big Five in various iterations. And there's a summary of that, but we're going to get to that in the next section. I'll explain what that test is. But this is something that's used in its place by people who take the discipline a little more seriously. Point C, and this is from a BBC.com article called Debunking the Myers-Briggs Personality Test by Anthony Zerker. He's the editor of Echo Chambers. This was written in July of 2014. And he says, Stromberg says one of the key flaws to the test is it relies on limited binaries. Most humans, he says, follow along a spectrum and are not easily classified into opposite choices. People aren't exclusively extroverts or introverts, and where they fall on the spectrum can fluctuate widely depending on how they're feeling at the moment. Most psychologists have long since abandoned Myers-Briggs, if they ever gave it any credence at all. Stromberg continues. Oh, instead, he says, Myers-Briggs lives on as a revenue generator for CPP, the company that owns the rights to the test. It makes an estimated $20 million a year by charging people $15 to $40 to take the survey and certifying test administrators for $1,700. Even the U.S. government, including the State Department and the CIA, use Myers-Briggs, a waste of taxpayer money, Stromberg says. It's 2014. Thousands of professional psychologists have evaluated the century-old Myers-Briggs, found it to be inaccurate and arbitrary, and devised better systems for evaluating personality. Let's stop using this outdated measure. which has about as much scientific validity as your astrological sign, and move on to something else. In a statement provided to the BBC, CPP President Jeffrey Hayes defends the test's validity. Quote, it's the world's most popular personality assessment, largely because people find it useful and empowering, and much criticism of it stems from misunderstanding regarding its purpose and design, he says. It is not and was never intended to be predictive and should never be used for hiring, screening, or to dictate life decisions. He says that organizations rely on the test, quote, for its practical benefits in career development, conflict handling, team building, and leadership development, end quote. Point D. Most lay people have no idea of its history or credibility. It's just a household name. Point E, lack of academic literature. Our show researcher searched for a literature review in the last 10 years and did not come up with anything, which is fairly telling because you can usually search for a literary review on anything and find one. And she could not find anything on this test and considers that indicative of how seriously the professional community takes it. But your average layperson doesn't know that, and this is why the test tends to persist. So with that, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you'd like to add before we go to the next part.
Yeah, in response to Jeffrey Hayes' comments, my response is, read my tongue. It is used to be, maybe it wasn't intended to be predictive, and I'll give him that, but that's what it's used for. In pragmatic stances, in most business, they use it to team, they don't use it just for conflict handling and team building, although some folks do that. They use it to match people's quote-unquote personality with positions within the company. So if that is predictive and that isn't used for screening or dictating life decisions, you don't know, I'm sorry, you're delusional. And they do that in companies. The other reason the companies use it is it's cheap. You can get a master's level person to administer it. You cannot get a master's level person to administer an MMPI. And so it saves them a boatload of money. They don't have to hire doctoral level folks to do the work for them. And it's quick and dirty and cheap. I mean, that's the bottom line. And it gives them the illusion of having something scientific, quote unquote, to make decisions about placement, personality placement, personnel placement and that sort of thing. It is absolutely used for that. I'm not suggesting that's the correct use for it, but I'm saying that is what it's used for in reality in many organizations. So that's crazy if he thinks it isn't. He's delusional. That's what they use it for. Whether it was intended for that or not, obviously that's not for me to say, but I'm just telling you what the reality is. It is used for that. And there are far better tests with a whole lot better statistics than the MBTI. That's all I'm saying.
Absolutely. And actually, our next section is going to cover that, but I'm going to go off script a little bit, extempore here. I have a question to put to you that I didn't really write down, but that has been bothering me. When this whole conversation came up about doing this topic, I had been somebody very interested in that test, and I had it administered by a professional psychiatrist not long after it came out and was popular in the 80s. And I've taken tests about 2 or 3 more times, and I've always come up with the same personality. So I'm curious. I know a lot of quizzes and things that people do online are pretty much bullshit. I get that.
Yes. Yes.
But do you have any thoughts on why it appears that the test seems to be functional and it gives people readings that seem to be in alignment with what they're doing? Do you think maybe they're falling into alignment with the test instead of the test indicating what's already there? Or what do you think is going on with that? Are we fooling ourselves?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think for some people, it's really accurate for some folks. But I don't think it's uber accurate for a lot of people for a lot of the time. You talk about that your MBTI, type has been fairly consistent for you over the years. That's not generally the case. So, you're sort of a statistical outlier in that regard. And that's great if that's the case for you and it works. That's awesome. I think also, as other folks much more erudite than I have pointed out, there's a social, you know, desirability factor. People are kind of reading between the lines and answering the way they think they want to look on the test. And there's no data checkers on that. And there is on the CPI, for example, the California, the 16PF, and the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which to me are much, much better tests. Now, what I would not do in an organization, and I don't want folks to mishear this, if you've got a relatively, you know, if you're looking to match people with strengths, because the MBTI is a strength-based test. It doesn't look at pathology. That's the other one of the other problems I have. It is looking to find strengths in people. It's this, what I call the Mr. Rogers mentality. It's a wonderful day in the Myers-Briggs neighborhood, right? And it's not looking to say, gee, honey, you might be, you know, a little foobard if, or gee, the guy, you might have a little problem if. It's looking to maximize and sanitize people, in my personal opinion. This is just one man's opinion, right? And that's not something that I think is necessarily the greatest thing on the planet if you're trying to match people with job situations. Now, likewise, on the other hand, I wouldn't use the MMPI either in a job situation if you have an otherwise functional employee to put him or her in a specific position. And that's why I typically, for those kind of things, I typically like to use or advise folks using things like the California Psych Inventory or the 16PF, which are sort of normal person's versions of the MMPI, as I call the MMPI. And they're much more focusing on non-pathological things, but they also say if you have too much of this aspect, you're probably not going to be a good team worker, a team player, and you're not going to probably be suited for this kind of position. And that's not pulling out pathology per se, but it's certainly making commentaries about, hey, you're a person that has these kind of tendencies. You probably want to stay away from this job and this job and this job and this job. And the online software, the matching up, you can get a profile that, you know, you take the CPI or the 16PF, and you can, you know, match your scores in with certain things now that they have on the test producers have the ability to do, and kind of match you up and what you would be good with and what you would not be good with. And I think that's much more helpful. Now, if you've got a sick puppy in the organization for whatever reason, and the organization says to selected individuals, hey, guys, hey, gals, you're having an anger problem. We think you have a drug problem. You've been caught with, you know, too many candy bars under your desk or whatever. And we want you to, you know, go see somebody. Now you whip out the mumpy, right? It's not something I would give as a normal selection process by any stretch of the imagination. I think that's very, very inappropriate use of that. But if you're going to do that kind of thing for employee selection and matching jobs and maximizing your corporations or your institution's manpower and woman power within the organization and making it most efficacious so it's a win-win for everybody, you're much, much better off doing a 16PF or a CPI. Much better off. They're much more reliable. They have much better. Their stats are very, very good, just as the MMPIs are. They're very, very, very good. And I just think you're much, much safer in terms of your ability to match stuff and predict people's likelihood of success, if you will, at the job you're assigning them to or you know, giving them to based on those tests than you would a Myers-Briggs. And again, maybe the Myers-Briggs wasn't initially intended to do that. And, you know, that's fine, but that's how it's being used in some places and actually in a lot of places. So that's the problem I have.
Got it. Okay. So, you know, as we have mentioned just a bit ago, there are several alternative tests that you might want to consider in a situation where you may have been doing the Myers-Briggs. So what are better tests to consider for what purposes instead is our next section. So number one, the Big Five model of personality dimensions or personality traits. That was what we mentioned earlier when we said the Big Five. Decades of research on personality has uncovered five broad dimensions of personality. These so-called Big Five dimensions are called extroversion, which is your level of sociability and enthusiasm, agreeableness, which is your level of friendliness and kindness, conscientiousness, which is your level of organization and work ethic, emotional stability, which is your level of calmness and tranquility, and intellect, which is your level of creativity and curiosity. This model was defined by several independent sets of researchers. The initial model was advanced by Ernest Tupis and Raymond Cristall in 1961, but failed to reach an academic audience until the 1980s. In 1990, J.M. Digman advanced his five-factor model of personality, which Lewis Goldberg extended to the highest level of organization. These five overarching domains have been found to contain and subsume most known personality traits and are assumed to represent the basic structure behind all personality traits. At least four sets of researchers have worked independently for decades on this problem and have identified generally the same five factors. Tupis and Crystal were first, followed by Goldberg at the Oregon Research Institute, Cattell at the University of Illinois, and Costa and McRae at the National Institutes of Health. Point B. The top five alternatives to the Myers-Briggs test, and this is from MeetCentral.com, March of 2015 by Jason Compton. The first one is the Big Five, which we already covered above. This is a very popular one suggested as an alternative. Next one is called Predictive Index, or PI. This is administered by PI Worldwide, which was founded in 1955. The Predictive Index isn't a test taken for laughs. It's all business, baby. Quote, MBTI is also used in academia and in personal coaching, but the Predictive Index was specifically designed for a business context, says Matt Popesol, who's the VP of Product Management at PI Worldwide. The next one is called Traitify, you know, like traits, and this is a career test. Traitify is carving out a niche in personality assessment that feels more like Tinder than the stolid Web 1.0 approach many of the entrenched tests offer. The startup shows test takers a series of photos with representative captions and asks you to click or tap me, or not me. After a few dozen images, you get an assessment. Most Traitify results are chosen from a list of seven possible fits, and summaries are generated based on the top two results, such as analyzer slash visionary or planner slash mentor. If you're looking for a test that, quote, gets millennials and even younger types, Traitify is it. The origin story of the Traitify system is that it was developed after the co-inventor flamed out on a blind date and wanted to develop a system to match fun activities with personality types. That resulted in the defunct WooFound Explore service, which Traitify shuttered when it rebranded and focused on reselling the testing platform to other businesses. And then there are two more that are emotion-focused tests. First one is the Adaptive Resilience Factor Inventory and the Meyer-Salovey-Caruso L-Test. The Adaptive Resilience Factor Inventory uses the concept of emotional resiliency as a lens to the greater personality. Oh, not L. Pardon me, that was EI. Sorry, that was a typo. Pardon me. So, and the second part, Emotional Intelligence, or EI or EQ, scoring is a popular non-proprietary approach. One of the most popular, the Meyer-Salovey-Caruso EI test, examines emotional perception through facilitation, emotional understanding, and emotion management. And those are the tests that people often recommend. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis. You mentioned a couple tests that were not on my list. So if you don't mind, can we talk about those for a second, what they are, since I didn't?
Sure. So the California Psych Inventory, Psychological Inventory, CPI, has been around for a long time. It was developed directly from the MMPI, and it's the, as I like to call it, the normal person's MMPI. So a lot of times if I'm having an athlete come in to see me, for example, or a business exec who's getting burned out, or an athlete who's having a performance slump, and the athlete or the business exec or whatever, you know, is not a cocaine user, they don't have a serious personality disorder, they're not majorly depressed, anxious, whatever, I'm not going to insult them by giving them an MMPI, which is going to subsume that they have pathology that's resulting in their performance decrements or the burnout factor. So the CPI is much better at identifying where they are in terms of continuums of stuff. And that's the other advantage of both the CPI and the 16PF. These things aren't introvert, extrovert, right? They are on, everything's on a continuum of lesser and greater. So you get much more specificity on the degree of a trait that you might have. And so if you're in a sport, let's say you're in a sport like golf, you know, or something that's very controlling, you have to be very controlled and very introspective and, you know, on your game, no pun intended, for a change, on your physical stuff and aware of your stress level and your frustration management and, you know, individual versus team sport, the CPI will give you a good idea. You know, are you in the wrong sport? Are you too keyed up to do this? Are you not focused enough to do that? You know, this is why you're having, and so from the results of the CPI, you can kind of get an idea of why somebody's having a brain fart on, you know, on the green, or why a business exec is having a hard time managing his or her underlings because they're coming out as too dominant on the CPI, let's say. You know, they're not balancing enough of the stuff. And the 16PF is the same thing. It's a 16 personality factors. So instead of having four, like the Myers-Briggs, this thing has 16 different factors of personality. And they're all, again, on a continuum. Do you like to work alone? Do you like to work with a team? Are you more self-driven and self-directed? Or do you, are you more reliant on somebody setting stuff up for me and follow, you know, a script? That's really important if you're in a business setting, to know what you're going to do, right? Or if you're in some kind of team, are you more of a, you know, independent, work alone, don't work well with you know, doesn't play well with others, kind of like me, you know? Or are you a person who really thrives on the group environment and it does more the, you know, group type stuff than the individual solitary stuff? Well, you can find all that stuff out with the CPI and or the 16PF. And sometimes I'll give both, because they measure various different dimensions and stuff. And so the data, and they're both very healthy. They're not going to say, oh, you have borderline personality disorder, oh, you have clinical depression, oh, you have conduct disorder. You know, they are not pathologically based tests. They are the average, you know, as Joe Walsh might say, the average ordinary guy and gal personality type test. And then based on the aspects of the job that you're taking, that you're looking to take, or the sport that you're engaging in, or whatever, or the coaching that you're doing for a team, you can really say, you're mismatched here, or, hey, this is what you need to tweak up a little bit in order to match with your job, or you can look for a job that has these kind of traits that maximize your skill set. So they're both very positive in that regard. They're not pathological like the Mumpy is, but they're also very, very detailed, and they have a multitude of factors, all of which are on a continuum. And they don't have 80 or 90 questions. They're like, you know, 200 questions. I don't remember how much each one of these things has. But it's not, you know, you can take it in about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour. And the newer versions they have online, you can take them online. If you have a clinician who's certified to give them, you have to be, you know, you have to be a doctoral level clinician. You have to be certified through the company that publishes them to take them. I mean, you know, it's not just Joe Schmo or Jolene Schmo up there taking it, and it's not some, you know, jackleg person in a office giving this thing to people. I mean, you have to have a clinician doing it that is certified, if you will, or in my case, certifiable, to be able to, you know, has a high enough education level to be certified to administer the test. And that way they'll sell you the test just like the IQ test or the MMPI or whatever. So this is not some jackleg, you know, fly-by-night dilly. These are very, you know, very well-respected, been in the business a long time, and have both of them have great stats on them.
Okay.
And they're not just this forced choice kind of, would you like to do this or this? They have a couple of three choices. They're a forced choice in regard you have to pick a choice, but the problem I have with the Myers-Briggs is it's very either or, and most of the time I find myself going none of the above, and there's not an option for that. I've taken the MBTI. I absolutely despised it. I was so frustrated halfway through. I was like, I almost got up and walked out and said, this is biggest bunch of garbage I've ever seen, but I finished it just for the hell of it because I went, okay, you're halfway through. Get out, you know, get over it and, you know, hunker down and sit your little happy assets down back in the desk and finish this thing. But I hated it. I thought it was complete trash, frankly. No offense to the Myers-Briggs people when I say that. This is just one guy's opinion. We already had two people tonight that disagreed with me who are professionals. So, you know, I'm not trying to dissuade anybody from or encourage somebody to use the MMPI, Myers-Briggs type indicator or not. It just, I personally would never recommend it, and I really hated it and don't use it at all. And I would agree
Fair enough.
Most of the critiques I've heard of it, you know?
Yep. Okay. So with that, it is getting close to midnight, so... I'm going to check in with you. We just got done speaking, but since we're going to wrap up, is there anything else that you want to add about any of the other sections or something we didn't cover before we wrap up here?
No, not really. The adaptive resiliency factor inventory, by the way, is a cool little test. I've used it sometimes to look at resiliency factors in psychotherapy patients.
Okay, fair.
Well, because resilience is a really important thing to have, and if you don't have that, little slings and arrows of outrageous fortune make a much bigger deal than if you're this resilient person that, you know, you're kind of like the Monty Python person. You know, come back, it's a flesh wound, I'll bite your kneecaps off.
How about you?
That person would probably score very, very highly on the adaptive resilience factor in the Dory. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't know anybody like that at all.
No, not at all.
Fair enough. Alrighty, so since it's midnight, let's go ahead and wrap up. So this concludes our show on the Myers-Briggs MEPS. And we hope our listeners have a better understanding about this popular but empirically flawed test and some idea of how to accomplish the same kinds of self-awareness through other means. So on behalf of myself and Dr. Mathis and NDB Media, thank you to our listeners this evening. And appreciation also to those of you joining us later via podcast, iTunes, or whatever other means that you listen to us. We will see you guys in 2 weeks. That'll be Wednesday, June 13th at 11 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for a new topic brought to you right here on blogtalkradio.com. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on. Mm-hmm.